This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's in with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Yes, we are back to Thursday after Saturday's episode. What a legend Les Dennis was. I'm so pleased you all enjoyed that episode. What a lovely, lovely man. What stories. What a career. But yes, we're back to Thursday. I'm still in Dublin. I got up this morning and started running properly. Running this time, because at the end of May I am running in the Manchester 10K, and I reached out to a stand-up comedian and serious runner and podcaster, Rob Deering, and asked his advice about how to start. And he sent me a lovely email about training and regime, which I've incorporated this morning. So big shout out to Rob Deering. Thank you so much for that. I'm starting gentle, don't worry, but we'll get there. And I'm running the streets of Dublin, which is very, very nice indeed. On to this week's episode. It's episode 19. Can you hear that? What's that? The noises of the strange flat. It's not a strange flat, it's dead nice. Season 9, episode 19. We've only got one more week to go until we wrap up this season. Who's the last episode going to be? Episode 20? Seriously, I don't know yet. I haven't booked them. I don't know. There's a few people that we're trying to juggle dates with. But don't worry, it'd be great. They always are. Speaking of fantastic and great, episode 19 is with Amber Anderson. Now, if you have been glued to Peaky Blinders this season, the finale was on Sunday, I think. You'll know her very, very well from being in this season. And we finally managed to sit down and talk. She's incredible. This is up there with one of my favourites I've recorded, most definitely. She's very open, she's very honest about her time and career as a model before she stepped into acting. She talks about relationships with certain directors that may not be very healthy, so a bit of a trigger warning there. But do read the blurb as well, but I'm just letting you know because I know some people don't read it. You just go straight to it. I don't want anybody to be upset by what Amber discusses openly and candidly. What else surprises next week? Some information for you that I think is going to make you very, very happy. If you support us over on Patreon, we've got a fantastic lightning round of questions for our Patreon supporters with Amber. So do go over there. And if you feel that this season has been worthy, these free podcasts that we give you week in, week out, go to patreon.com/twoshotpod, two shot podcast. Griff sent me all the addresses. Patreon, just Google it, you'll find it. And if you could throw us any support, and when I say support, I mean money, please do that. What else? Not much else, really. I think we should probably get down to it, shouldn't we? Should we? Yeah, all right, go on then. This is the Two Shot Podcast, episode 19 of season 9. God, it's flown, I know. With the brilliant Amber Anderson. Enjoy, and I shall see you at the end. Lovely. Let's all take a sip of drink.
I've got a pot here of lemon balm calming tea.
I love tea.
Yeah.
And I love your... Can you just show me your teapot again, please? This is not good for podcast viewers, but it's great for me.
For people listening, it's a glass teapot with like a kind of built-in central brewer, diffuser.
Yeah.
And you put the loose leaf into the middle of it.
But it's a fantastically proud spout.
It's a very proud spout.
I was really trying to work out my word in then.
It's the kind of spout, though, that if it's a little bit too full and then you move it's suddenly...
Game over. Yeah.
It goes travelling on its gap year. It's like... But it's a great teapot. I love it. And, I just had a friend over in the afternoon and I ate my body weight in white chocolate buttons. And so about half an hour before we started this podcast, I had one of those sugar rushes where you go, oh my God, I'm going to die. And then I thought, I think I need some nice, relaxing, loose leaf tea.
Well, the reason why I'm having a Coke Zero here in front of you, we're not sponsored by Coke Zero, by the way. Mm-hmm. I was up at 4:30.
Oh, Jesus.
To go and participate in a stunt rehearsal, which I wasn't really needed for, but still.
Oh, cool.
No, it wasn't that cool at that time in the morning, to be honest.
Yeah.
So I just thought I need something to pep me up, really.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose... It's so funny that we're talking now because we've spoken in the past, but we don't know each other. We're not friends.
All right.
But no. That's horrible.
Cheers.
Look, we're not mates. It's fine. No, but
these things
are always something different. But I was going on to say that I knew this would be a nice, relaxed, open conversation because I feel that I know you, even though we don't, because I think we can say who your boyfriend, partner is, can't we?
Yeah, people know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and also Connor, when Connor came on the podcast all those years ago, was such, you know, a huge, massive... hit for everybody. And we've been in touch in the past with regards to work projects and we've discussed things, so it was only a matter of time before we got you on. And I think now at the finale of Peaky Blinders, which we'll talk about later on, because you know this podcast we don't talk about work that much, but I do want to discuss it later on. But I think what we should talk about first is possibly music.
Sure, yeah.
Is that a good way to start?
I think so. I mean, it was definitely what I thought I would end up doing when I was a kid.
Specifically the piano?
Yeah, I mean, I was always going to end up being on stage, I thought. I started thinking I'd be an actor when I was really young, like in primary school. And I went to a Steiner school, so I had a Waldorf education until I was about 10, which I don't know if people know, but it's...
Well, yeah, exactly, because I think because my son's 10, me and his mum flirted with that idea of the Steiner education. But for those that don't know, and for those that live outside the UK or possibly don't know, can you explain a little bit about the Steiner education?
Well, my understanding of it is that it's a sort of alternative style of education where they believe that kids should have the opportunity to be kids and develop their imaginations and develop their creativity. And it was founded by a man called Rudolf Steiner, which I thought, always think is a brilliant name.
It is.
Yeah, this is a ridiculous name. And he believed, I think, something along the lines that the human brain develops in 7-year cycles. And so he saw the first 7 years of a child's life as kind of sacred and literally this sort of childhood, like as in it should be like a hood that's over your head of safety and no kind of real obligation to be academic. And so you don't learn to read or write until you're 8. And sort of before the age of 8, it's very much centered around being outside, being in nature, learning how to sew, learning how to carve wood, learning how to, you know, build a den in the forest. And
but also playing.
Yeah,
lots of interaction.
Yeah, yeah. And then also, once you do begin to get into the sort of academic side of things, you don't do your lessons by subject, you do your lessons by topic. So instead of like maths, English, geography, music, you'll study something like ancient Egypt. And then within the topic of ancient Egypt, you will learn about maths, English, spelling, music. You know, you'll have all of those things worked into the kind of overall topic of whatever it is you're studying. And so it's basically a very creative environment. And I think my mum really, really wanted me to have that kind of start in life. And I was already a really big reader. And her plan of sort of putting off the reading until the age of 8 didn't really work very well, because before we moved to Scotland, when we lived in England before that, I went to a kind of...
Was that in Somerset?
Yes. So I was born in Glastonbury in Somerset. And then we moved around a little bit within that part of the world. But then when I was 6, we moved up to Scotland. And sort of just before that, I'd gone to like a regular state primary school in England and basically had learned to read in the space of about 6 months. And so I was sort of at the Steiner School, sitting in the back of the classroom while all the other kids were learning the alphabet, kind of like reading books and stuff. And just really, really cool, you know. But I think it was an amazing start. And it definitely put me on a track of thinking that I would end up doing something artistic, like, for sure.
But I think it does. I'm not at all poo-pooing Steiner education at all, because I think it is incredible.
Mm.
And it does facilitate and put that creativity right there for the children.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's every education is an individual process.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah. And I think for me, I mean, we'll get onto this, but I ended up going to music school, but it was joined onto a very normal local state high school. And so I ended up doing all of the more academic things. And I think that was really good for me to have a bit of both, because actually I am also fairly academic. And so I think potentially being in Steiner until I was 18 might have been slight kind of creative overkill, you know? And I think when I have kids and what I would want to do, I love the idea of them going to Steiner schools, but I wonder if maybe the good balance of it would be up until about the age of 10 or 11, you know, and then giving them a chance to do something a little bit more regular. I don't know.
It's hard, isn't it? Because then you've got to think about the transition.
Mm.
When they've been in that bubble for so many years, to move them into state or private or whatever education, it's like, oh, it's kind of different. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's
the same thing. It's like, do you raise your kids in the city or in the countryside? Like, do you want them to be streetwise and, you know, be able to navigate a city, or do you want them to have the safety and the freedom and the sort of luxury of the space of the countryside. It's a really tricky...
Well, it's a really tricky balance. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, when we had our son, you know, at the end of May, he's 11. So this year he's going into secondary school. And we'd been in London for so long, it was like, I don't know if I want to raise our child in London. I'm not sure. I don't know if emotionally one thing we can balance that. I'm not sure. And so we moved out, and loads of people know this, we moved out to the countryside. And it's, is it safer? Well, I don't know. Mm. I don't think so. I think, you know, you dip into the city, you have a different relationship with a city than you do to the countryside. So, as I'm sure you did growing up.
Yeah, yeah. You know? But then I think on the flip side of that, you know, I basically was a country girl until I was 17. And then I moved to London on my own at 17. And just was like, my mind was boggled by London. You know, on the one hand, it was so exciting and like, oh my God, this is the place I've always wanted to live. And isn't this amazing? But on the other hand, I mean, I was really naive, you know. I was really naive, and I really got myself into certain situations that I think if I'd maybe been a bit more streetwise, maybe I wouldn't have gotten into, because I think I was just naturally very trusting of everyone. And
yeah, but the thing is, it is so tricky, but you were 17.
Yeah.
I was 17, and I was from a seaside town.
Yeah.
And I moved to London at that time.
Mm.
And I was stupidly naive.
Oh, my God.
You know?
Yeah.
Were there times when you were worried about moving to London at that time? Or certain situations that you got yourself into, or situations were thrust upon you?
Not until, I think, after the fact. I'd quit music school at 16. I decided that I didn't want to be a musician and that I wanted to be an actor. And I had gotten
which we're going to go back on this, by the way. We are going to jump around.
And I got a scholarship to this school called Gordonston, which is quite a posh private school up in Scotland. And I had gotten a very amazing thing, which is that I'd wanted to be an actor. I'd auditioned for the drama scholarship and I'd auditioned for the music scholarship because I'd been at music school. So that was like kind of an obvious thing to go for. And they both wanted to give me the scholarship, but they couldn't give one student two scholarships. So they made me a new scholarship. And so I went to Gordonston under this sort of new thing that they'd created, which was like what they called a performing arts scholarship. But what that meant was I basically had to kind of major in two things, which they hadn't ever really asked of any student before. And I'd also just started modelling, and I'd also just gone to London for the first time, age 16, on my own for 2 months and done photo shoots and thought I was, you know, 35, and actually I was still a child. So I was like smoking cigarettes and stuff. And I got to Gordonston and I so desperately wanted to be a proper trained actor. I always thought I'd be a theatre actor, to be honest. Screen ended up being kind of just what happened, I think, because I didn't train, you know, in the end. And I got to Gordonston and I mean, all respect to the school, I hated it. I was too independent already. You know, I'd already been in London for 2 months and thought I was, you know, the shit. And I sort of got caught smoking 3 times in my first term by one of the house mistresses, and I got sort of grounded effectively. And I was just really miserable. And also, I had sort of said to them, because I'd been scouted to be a model, I'd said, listen, you know, the scholarship's amazing, but I can't afford to come here unless I do a few modelling jobs here and there and kind of put myself through this school. And the admissions people had sort of gone, yeah, 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 that's fine, that's fine, that's fine. And then when I got there, the sort of reality of me actually missing class and missing, especially in the drama department, you know, missing rehearsals and stuff, the teachers sort of understandably didn't really like. And so it got to a point where they were like, well, no, you can't leave to go and model. We need you here. You're a scholar. Mm. You're supposed to be leading the department. And I was sort of put in a kind of an impossible situation, really. And so I left after a term and a half. And so in a sense, I kind of moved to London because I literally didn't have anything else to do. I'd sort of made the decision that I was leaving school. I had an agent already, which was quite lucky. And I just kind of got to a point really where I thought, well, I've got an agent. I'm already in a situation that, you know, a lot of people my age aren't even in yet. So why am I not moving to London and starting to audition and trying to make it work? But it did definitely create a sense that there was a necessity to it, that I didn't have any backup option. And it was very difficult in my family. You know, my mum was very against me moving to London. Understandably, she was very scared of what might happen. My dad was quite supportive, but he kind of very sweetly was like, I'll always be there for you, but I can't physically afford to help you. So if you are going to move to London, you need to know that you're doing this on your own, you know. And I was like, yeah. And I'd done one modelling job for Jack Wills, which in those days was really quite exciting. And I had something like $2,500, which my 17-year-old self thought was like so much money.
It was at 17.
Gonna
my God.
Keep me going for years in London.
Look, I was working in Pizza Hut in Wood Green. And it was loads of money for me, and I was getting all the free pizza I could deliver to my drama school mates on the sly. Yeah. It was the best gig in the world.
Yeah, I thought it was a lot of money, and I was naive, and so I moved to London with this $2,500. I think it was $2,500, and then obviously, you know, I found a little room on Gumtree in a flat in Homerton. This is 13 years ago, before Homerton was gentrified.
Yeah, of course.
Coffee shops. It was really, really kind of quite dicey sometimes. And I ran out of money after about 2 months. Because of course I did, because I was living in London, and London was really expensive. And sort of no one had told me, as both an actor and a model, that just because you had an agent didn't necessarily mean that you would really get jobs. And I just didn't get jobs, you know. And so I moved to London thinking that would be it, and that I would be, you know, on a roll. And then nothing happened. You know, I got some auditions, but I didn't have a clue how to be an actor. I didn't have a clue how to act. You know, I'd only done school plays. I had no idea about screen acting. And I was trying to model to kind of pay for myself to stay in London and support myself. But it's the same as a model, you know. It sometimes takes a year of going to castings before anything happens. And so it got to a point where I was doing waitressing and working in shops, and I was a personal assistant to someone at one point. And it just became sort of untenable, really. And so I ended up moving back to Scotland and actually getting the night bus to London for auditions, because it was cheaper to live in Scotland and get the night bus to go for an audition than it was to obviously live in London.
No.
And so that whole year was just on the bus back and down to Victoria, you know, brushing my teeth in Victoria Coach Station. But then kind of because I was modelling, I was getting into situations where, you know, other girls would be like, oh, come out tonight with this promoter to this club. And I'd be like, yeah, of course. And I'd go, you know, to some awful like Mayfair club with like sleazy older men. And so I was very exposed very quickly, I think, to like a very dark and sort of quite seedy side of London. And I sort of look back at my 17-year-old self and just kind of want to give her a hug and be like, oh God, babe, like, come in, let me give you a cup of tea. You know?
Yeah. Can we just roll back a bit about being scouted for a model?
Yes.
Because you hear and you read all the time about, oh, well, I met somebody in TK Maxx or on the street, or how did it happen for you? Because I would be, if I had a daughter, and I don't, when she was approached, I would be extremely wary about whether it would be genuine.
Yeah.
Because obviously you hear so much.
Oh, my God.
Especially now with, certainly with certain actors that have come to light about auditions and, you know, things that you may have to take your clothes off, which, listeners, you never have to do.
And as models, I know this isn't a modelling podcast, but
it's a creative podcast. It's a personal podcast, but so you can say whatever you like.
Well, with models, there's a big thing of like, you know, dodgy agencies sort of asking you to pay up front for pictures and things. So, you know, you'll get sort of inverted commas scouted, and then they'll be like, oh, could you pay us £800 for this photo shoot? And then you'll get jobs. And so people shell out all this money. And I think the main thing I've always said to when I was modelling, because I'm not now actually, but when I was, you know, and people would ask me for advice, I'd be like, never, ever, ever pay up front for anything, because you never should. And also I think just, it's not normal to be asked to take your clothes off when you're 16, you know, and things that when you're very young and people ask you to do, you feel obligated to do because you don't want to cause a fuss and you want to get a job and you want to be liked. And
I don't want to interrupt you here, although I am.
Please.
Was that ever something that you were asked to do when you were young?
Oh my God, yeah. Like I was lucky because... So I was scouted by a really good agency. I'll tell you how I was scouted, actually,
okay.
Quickly. I was at music school and very just into my piano and thinking I was going to be a pianist. And my friend at music school said... She and a couple of other people had started to say, oh, you should model, you're really tall, or, like, you should model, you've got great skin. And I was just like, what? Like... Don't think so. That's ridiculous. Because I was just like, I was a music kid. You know, all I did was play piano. And you know, I was bullied at school for quite a few years. And I wasn't confident at all. I did not see myself in any way, shape or form as like subjectively good looking. I didn't even kiss a boy until I was 16. I was so late to every party. And so when people started suggesting I could be a model, I was like, well, I think you're on something. But my friend at music school found this advert in this teen magazine called Sugar Magazine, which was like a very big...
I remember Sugar.
You remember Sugar?
I remember Sugar.
And Sugar Magazine did a model competition, and it was sponsored by Rimmel Cosmetics. And it was... in partnership with ICM Models, which was the model division of ICM, which now is independent. And she was like, you've got to enter this competition. Like, and when you enter, you get £150 worth of free Rimmel makeup, which we all know is a lot of mascara. And so I was like...
Even I know that.
Even yes. You know that. So I was like, sign me up. I'm down.
I'm in.
And so it was in the October holidays at school, and we went down to Glasgow because they were doing these road shows in different shopping centres around the UK. And Glasgow was the only Scottish one, and we were at school in Aberdeen, so it was quite a few hours of trains and buses and various things. And we got there, and I was scouted in the queue for the thing. And this woman, who was actually, in the end, it turned out, a very famous model scout called Ellis... Fiona Ellis, kind of came up to me just staring at me and was like, hello, are you here for the competition? And I was like, yes, I am. And she said, oh, can I come and take some pictures of you? And she took me up to the sort of top floor of the shopping centre, which was empty. It was just like no shops, just like sort of glass ceiling. And she took pictures of me for about sort of 45 minutes. It felt like forever. And I was just shaking. And... that was how I got scouted, basically. And so I then sort of entered the competition anyway and got the makeup.
So did you win?
No, well, I got into the UK top six of the Sugar Mag model competition. And I didn't win, but they signed me anyway. And that's how I got it. So I was very lucky because I got scouted by a good agency, and they then later on became independent models, and then they became another agency altogether. But I basically had the same agents for like 15 years. I never left them.
Right.
And they were great. And so I did have difficult situations, but they were very rarely because of that agency. It was always in other places like New York or Athens in Greece, you know, because as a young model, you would be sent to these other places to go with an agency in another city for a while and live there and, you know, do castings and do shoots and get some pictures for your book and stuff, which would be, you know, your portfolio that you would take around and show to potential clients. And I remember in Greece, there was a situation, because at that point, Athens was for some reason a very popular place for like young models who needed photographs. And I was in Athens for a month and I was 17. And again, this is, I had no money. I was living off about 50 euros a week. And the agency said, oh, we've got you this shoot with, you know, Greece's most successful swimwear photographer or something.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, great. And it was me and this other British girl. And he picked us up in his car from the hotel. And he drove us like 2 hours outside of Athens. And this is in the days like before iPhones, you know, I literally had a black and white phone and an A to Z of Athens, like that I just did not know where I was. And we got to the house and that nobody was there. It was just us, this guy, and this other kind of older guy who owned the house. There's no hair and makeup, no stylist, no anything. And it was a really dodgy situation. And he said, you know, go to the bathroom. I'll bring you your first outfit. And he tried to get me to wear like basically a G-string. Mm. And I said, I'm not wearing that. And, you know, and the other girl got put in those clothes. And it was a very weird shoot. And I think in the end, I was sort of okay because I didn't really compromise and I didn't really get naked in a way that I didn't want to. But if you think about it in terms of like the facts of that situation, it's two 17-year-old girls in a foreign country. Nobody knows where they are. And you're being driven to a mysterious location by a much older man who's asking you to wear basically nothing. It's like, it's so messed up in so many ways, you know.
And you're 2 hours outside of Athens in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean, the scales of power are tipped firmly in this person's favour. And it's just, that's a horrible situation.
And I think, you know, I will say that I mainly had a really good time being a model, but I did have very dodgy situations. But I think what I will say is that when I mean, I was always acting as well, but when the balance kind of tipped and I became more an actor than I was a model, it felt like walking into a warm hug, really, because I felt like, and I have had extremely dodgy situations as an actress as well. But I think on the most, you know, for the most part, I think there's a respect of actors as, I want to say artists, whereas no,
you absolutely can, and you should, yeah.
Whereas I think models are, you know, I think seen as very dispensable and kind of, yeah, like a commodity, I think. In a way, I think more than actors are. And I think as an actor, you're valued for your personality, or at least I hope you are.
Well, but also it's that thing, Amber, isn't it? When you stroll on set for the first time and you're meeting a plethora of, like, new people, or you're going on to established job, which you've just done, like, on Peaky Blinders.
Yeah.
You have to forge, and I've said this before, you have to forge relationships, but genuine relationships, quickly and be genuine and not be fake and just kind of throw it out there and hopefully, you know, the magnets stick together, you know. Yeah. And you know, and they do nine times out of ten. I say nine times, about seven. I've been doing it 25 years.
Yeah.
But you know, they do stick together, and which is always a joy, really.
Yes. Yeah, totally. So
after this, was this
a time for you when you thought maybe I should turn my back on the modelling and concentrate on the acting? Or was there another time that you thought, I think I need to focus on solidly on acting?
I think I began, it was very gradual. I was modelling, I mean, that happened when I was 17 and I was modelling until I was 26, basically.
Like, right, okay.
So I modelled for a long time, and it's to give it credit, it's the only way I've actually managed to afford to be an actor in London, you know, and so it's, and other things, I got to see the world and travel in a way that I think I never would have done otherwise. But it was a very gradual thing. I think I began to realise that at the beginning, a lot of people had said, oh, these two careers are perfect. They go hand in hand perfectly. They complement each other. It's perfect. Loads of models are becoming actors now, blah, 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 blah.
Did you feel that?
Well, I just believed them. And then I...
Because it was told to you?
Yeah. And, right. and it was told to me, to be honest, mainly by people in the modelling industry. And then I began to realise something that I thought was kind of interesting, which is that I felt like they were very, very happy for me to be an actor because it gave them something else to kind of sell me on, you know, as a model. But when it came to actually taking time off to be an actor and doing things to be an actor, like cut my hair or dye my hair or something, that was a bit more of a problem. And so it was kind of like it worked very well for the modelling for me to be an actor just by kind of name. But when it came to the actual kind of reality of really committing myself to being an actor, it wasn't taken that well. And then also, I think being a model, it does a very different thing to your physicality. Like, it makes you very, very aware of yourself in a very outward way. And my agent kind of called me into her office one day and she was like, you need to relax. And I was like, what do you mean? She was like, I can tell that you care so much about being taken seriously as an actor because you're a model, and I'm seeing it in your tapes, and I'm seeing it in the way that you're holding your face in your tapes, and I can see that you're trying to always be pretty, and that you care so deeply about being taken seriously, but you've sort of got the modeling in you as well, and I just need you to relax. And it was kind of the best thing she ever said to me, really, because that,
I mean,
was, yeah,
it was something I wanted to talk about models moving into acting,
yeah,
and the worry that they would be taken seriously. Because I worked last year with a fantastic actress who has a background in modelling.
Mm.
I mean, and she's fucking incredible, as you know, as you are. So, but it's like that is going to be a stigma that you would carry around because, you know, you go, oh, that's my background and I'm moving to something else now.
But I also wonder if it's because I didn't take me seriously. Like, and that's not a kind of diss on modelling at all, but I kind of...
No, but it's more about being self-referential of yourself.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And there is an outside perception, I think.
Absolutely. Well, it's also, case in point, people in the music industry moving into acting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Well, or stand-up comedians coming into acting. Well, how dare you come into this? I wouldn't pop into your world.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's different.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
it's a very personal experience.
and journey. It's a very personal journey.
Yeah, and I definitely noticed as well that I think, and I think it's different for everyone, but I think I see this a lot, which is that I think I became a better actor with age, to be honest. Like, I think in my early 20s, I was by nature self-conscious and confused and a bit chaotic and a bit all over the place, and that's great for some characters, but I definitely felt like I settled more into myself as a person and then also as an actor, if that makes sense. And I think settling into myself came largely from realizing that while I loved modelling and I was very grateful for it, I didn't necessarily want it to be my whole life. And I definitely didn't want to be defined, I suppose, by how I looked. And I think I felt also a bit like I wasn't using all of my skills. You know, I'd gone to music school and I had trained very intensely as a musician. And I knew I didn't want to be a pianist necessarily, but I really, really knew that I wanted to go more towards being kind of, you know, around other creative people and around, you know, the people who I felt like were my people. And whenever I did an acting job and met other actors, I was like, oh yes, this is my people. As cringy as that sounds, but yeah.
No, it's the thing is, it's not cringy at all, because we learned so much about who we work with as artists and actors. It's just the way it happens. And that is what strives us and keeps us going.
Yeah.
I think, you know,
it's about the people for me, 100%.
100%.
It's like, and if there's terrible people, the job for me is like intolerable.
I mean, look, have you ever been on a job where it just doesn't fit? It just, the jigsaw just doesn't fit. And
yeah.
And we all have. And I'm sure everybody listening to this has been on that job. Right.
Yeah.
And you went into it with the best intentions.
Yeah.
And I remember doing something many years ago, and I went into it with the best intentions, and I don't think I was completely the best me in the world at all. But it was just like, oh God, I don't know what to... It was the only point in my life that I went, I don't think I can do that. I remember going home to the apartment I was in London, and I went, I don't think I can do this anymore. I remember calling a friend of mine, crying, going, I'm so upset. And I don't want to have a career or earn a living from something that's going to upset me so much, and I'm going to be so distraught about how people think of me or the work that I do. And he's just like, oh, well, actually, what you need to do is just throw that aside for a bit and just embrace what's going on.
I think it's really important to be able to do that. I actually had an experience on a film where I was properly traumatized, and
Can we dive into this a little bit? Because I'm really interested in how other people deal with it. And it's not about the job; it's about certain situations and environments that they're in. Because I think people can learn off it.
Yeah. No, I'm happy to talk about it. I think a part of me a year or two ago would have been worried in case one of the people from the film were listening or something. But then now I'm a bit like, well, if they are, then so what? Because they were terrible.
Well, it's a good job we didn't talk together about a year ago, isn't it? So,
yeah, exactly.
So it's perfect.
But you know, that kind of people-pleasing side of all of us, I think, where you go, even when you've been treated badly, you worry about their feelings. Whereas
in my 20s and possibly early 30s, complete people pleaser. Had to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I got a film about 4 years ago, and it was a horror film. And it was to play the lead.
You don't have to say what it is, by the way. People can...
That's the end of the story. Yeah.
Amber, I mean, I love talking to you. It's a terrible story so far. Carry on, please.
Everything that could... Anyway, horror movie, playing the lead, playing a girl who's schizophrenic, who gets traumatised, with a first-time director... Thank you for coming to my TED talk. That is the end of the story.
Well, the thing is, I've been lucky and unlucky over the years to work with some incredible first-time directors, but also,
yeah,
you know, the latter.
Yeah.
And it is a lottery. I think it is a lottery.
Yeah, it is. And I also think the subject matter is you know, it's a thing. Like, if it's a horror movie, it just is going to be a bit more intense and a bit more emotionally all over the place.
Can we, do you mind if we discuss why it was so awful?
No. Well, so I wanted to do it because it was my first lead, and it was just around the time I was beginning to stop modelling properly. And so I still was in that space of, like, desperate to be taken seriously as an actress and desperate to be, you know, seen as really, like, I was deserved to be in the industry, I think. And so the film came along, and I mean, to be honest, looking back now, the script was terrible, but I didn't care because it was just the chance to play a lead in this film. And I auditioned and I got it, and I was really over the moon. And the director, I could tell from the beginning, was like a very intense, thought he was Kubrick type auteur, or at least wanted to be an auteur type guy. And everything was very intense and very psychological. And this script had the most stage directions I've ever seen in my life. Like, there was maybe no dialogue, or not much dialogue. And then it would be like pages of descriptive stuff to do with the psychology of what was going on in her head and stuff like that, which I now kind of, to be honest, would see as a red flag in a weird way, because I feel like you've got to trust the actors enough to, like, figure things out, I think, a bit.
Yeah, but also sometimes there's things like that and you go, you can sort that out on set or on the floor.
Yeah, yeah. And so I signed up to do the film, and then the first red flag was that there was a couple of scenes that involved, like, some kind of nudity. There wasn't any sex scenes or anything, but there was, like, a fight scene and things like that. And I asked for what is very, I think, normal, especially these days, which was a nudity clause in the contract. And he sent me an email saying how upset he was that I obviously wasn't committed enough to the film because I was asking for a nudity clause, and that the nudity clause was sort of, you know, encroaching on his artistic freedom. And that, again, was the first first red flag that I saw, but just went, oh, but I just really want to play the lead in this film and it's probably going to be fine, so I'm going to do it anyway. And I went to Luxembourg, because obviously it was filming in Luxembourg. And, you know, it was to play this girl who basically had schizophrenia. And it was, the film was basically this girl being traumatized for the whole time. And he really kind of seemed to like the fact that I'm totally comfortable talking about this, but I have anxiety. I've had panic attacks. I've had depression. I have very personal history with all of those. I'm not schizophrenic, but I have personal history with those very extreme feelings. And he really wanted to sort of draw on that and turn it into this kind of weird method situation. And
on a sort of personal note to you, he was to take something from you to turn it and incorporate into the film.
Like, he would take personal things I told him, private things I told him.
Right.
And then would, like, come up to me on a set and say, just remember this thing you told me. You know, it was like he was trying to steer how I reached for certain feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to get me to listen to certain music before going for takes and things, which again, I would be like, well, why can't I choose my own music that will help me get into that feeling?
Exactly, yeah.
And we started filming, and the first 2 weeks were actually quite amazing. And I actually had the experience of feeling like I was holding the responsibility of this whole film and kind of carrying it. And I was feeling really kind of empowered, and I was really enjoying going into these very extreme emotional places. And it was feeling fun, actually, which I think is I think a very important point to make is that it should feel fun, like, even if it's extreme.
But also safe.
And safe, yeah, and trusting.
Yeah.
And respectful. Mm. And then in the second week, there was a scene where I had to be possessed, and I had to circle a man in a cage and then violently attack him while he was inside this cage. And I went to the director a couple of days before and I was like, so what are you thinking for this cage thing? Because there wasn't really anything in the script. And he said, yeah, I don't know, like maybe it's a mixture of like, you know, when people are on crack, but then also like maybe you're like a cat in heat. And I was like, so, okay, so you have no idea what you want, which is fine.
And also, I can relate to all of that.
Yeah. I was like, okay.
What the fuck?
What the fuck? Oh, good. So we are allowed to swear on this podcast.
Oh, you can please swear away.
So we went for the scene and it was exhausting. It was in a basement in this dingy house. I was in a nightdress because obviously... because all women in horror movies apparently are wearing nighties. And because he basically didn't have a fucking clue what he wanted, I had to just improvise this being possessed, attacking the guy. I was doing little moments that I thought were brilliant of, you know, trying to fight the possession, like almost coming out of it for a second and going, no, no, I can't. And we did it for about 2 hours. And it was really exhausting. And then me and the guy in the cage... that my fellow actor said, we're just going to have a cup of tea now. Because no one had called any break. You know, he'd just gone and gone and gone and gone. So we were kind of let out of this situation, given cups of tea. Me and the other actor kind of sat there like, whoa, this is really suddenly quite intense. And I was told that we were done for that scene. And then they came back and they said, actually, Amber... what we want to do now is a shot where the camera is the guy in the cage. So the camera is the POV of the guy in the cage. And we now want you to do the whole thing again on your own, but
on
to
you.
Camera, on me.
Oh, God.
So I was like, oh, God, okay. So we went back down into this room and I then had to do another take of this really intense screaming, crying, spitting, fucking attacking this guy. And... there was no discussion. We just went for the take and he didn't cut. And he kept the camera rolling for 20 minutes and he didn't cut. And no. It got to the point where I felt dizzy and I felt upset because it was traumatizing. You don't do that to an actor. You do not say, if you say before, hey, listen, would it be okay if we maybe did a bit of a rolling take here and see what happens? Different story.
Of course, because it's all about trust and discussion.
And consent, actually.
Yes, and consent.
And he just didn't do that. And so he didn't cut. And so I was basically, it was a power thing. And I was just left in this very emotionally extreme place. And I looked down the barrel of the lens. Because he wasn't even in the room. He was upstairs behind his sunglasses having a cup of tea.
he sounds so great.
He's such a cool guy. And I looked down the barrel of the lens and I said, I'm done. And I was really, really firm about that. And I cut the scene. And he stormed off set, didn't speak to me, called the day. And it was on a Friday. And then over the weekend, I got these texts basically telling me that I was undirectable, that I was sabotaging his film, that I was sabotaging his creativity, that I was impossible to work with, and that I should be ashamed of myself for being so unprofessional. And I went back to set on the Monday, and he didn't direct me for the whole day. So he deliberately only spoke to the other actors on the set. And he would look at me and then he'd just walk right past. And this was 2 weeks into a 12-week shoot where I had 44 filming days on that job. And I remember that so specifically because obviously I got into a situation where I was like going 44, 43, 42.
How the hell did you keep that together?
Well,
we spoke about panic attacks before because, I mean, I've experienced those in the past. I don't know how I would be able to keep that together after a two-week into.
Yeah, it was really hard. And he started doing things like not having stunt people around for when he wanted stunts. You know, there was a scene when he wanted the other actor to actually slap me across the face, and he was being very, very, very firm about the fact that he wanted a real slap.
Oh, so he was being abusive?
Oh, it was abuse, yeah. It was psychological abuse.
Oh, my God.
And then he was
physical and psychological abuse.
Yeah. And I kind of put up with it. And then there was a moment about 8 weeks in where there was a kissing scene, and it was written that I would end up taking my top off, and I'd kind of said to him in rehearsals that I was quite strict about no nipples, and you know, I would take the top off, but it had to be implied. And in the scene, in the middle of the take, he screamed across the set, being like, "You're not naked enough. I need you to be more naked." And I, this was again on a Friday, and I went. By this point, I was fucking done. I was so done.
Of course.
And I called the producer, who hilariously was called Jesus, or Jesus.
Hopefully he performed miracles.
And by that point, because, you know, the thing is the only thing that had kept me going back to set was because I was still so scared of being fired for some reason. I was still so scared of, like, not finishing the job and letting people down and letting him down. And I was thinking about everybody except myself.
Yeah, of course. But how old were you at this point, Amber?
26.
Still
That's, young.
Yeah, so young, so young. I'm also so fresh into it.
Oh, my God, yeah. And I'm totally still trying to prove myself.
And, of course, and completely manipulating.
You know.
Please.
And
No,
I went back and I can't remember if I called Jesus or emailed Jesus. But anyway, I sent Jesus a message and I was like, "I'm not going back to set on Monday unless you fly here and we have a meeting, because this isn't how I fucking work. This is not okay. He's not Kubrick. And even if he was, this isn't okay. Like, you do not treat actors like this. This is appalling." And I was proud of myself for doing that. And he and the producer came to, we were in Belgium by this point. He flew to Belgium. And we pulled the director out of lunch and pulled him into my trailer. And Jesus sat there like a kind of couples therapist and was like, "Amber's got some things that she'd like to say to you." And this fucking guy sat behind his sunglasses the whole time. So disrespectful. Anyway, and I basically just started giving him all of the reasons why he was being a massive...
cunt.
Douche.
A massive cunt. And, let's just say that.
And at first he was going, "Oh, Amber, come on, we're not on one of your modelling shoots anymore. This is real art."
Oh, my blah, blah, blah. God, he didn't say that.
And I was going, and I actually, honestly, Craig, I was going, "Go fuck yourself. Go fuck yourself.
Go fuck yourself."
Yeah, like, I know who I am. I know that I'm not completely established, but I know that this is not how you do things.
I mean, talk about...
And this is abusive.
Being a manipulative cunt.
And then, by the end of about an hour and a half, he was going, "Thank you so much for starting this conversation. I'm so happy we did this." And I was going, "Yeah, too fucking right." And then the last sort of 3-4 weeks, he still tried to pull all sorts of stuff. Like, he was still trying to get actors to do things that were unsafe to me and things. But by that point, I was just going, "No, not doing it." And then also, interestingly, other crew members. So, like, I remember at one point the key grip stood up and he was like, "If you try and make her do that, I'm walking off." And so there was a sense of sort of, in a way, like mutiny, you know, where like everyone was really done with it. And but it was really dangerous. And there was a scene that he made me do where he made me get into a lake in Belgium in November where it was 4 degrees. And my body went into shock and I had a panic attack. And I didn't know that this was unsafe. But the thing that they'd got for me after the lake was a hot tub. And so they took me from an icy lake.
What?
And put me in a hot tub, which someone told me later on, and I think this is important for anyone listening to know this.
Yeah.
It could kill you.
Yes.
You're not supposed to go from really cold to really hot. Like,
no.
And so just the whole thing, honestly, was traumatic. And I finished the job and I kind of felt proud of myself for having gotten through it. And I was very emotional when it wrapped. And then I had a day And then I went on to another film in Canada with the nicest people in the world. Like, honestly, it was so healing. And then I did that film. And then I got Emma, which was a film I did, where I met Connor, actually.
Yeah.
And then I basically went straight into Emma. And so by the time I'd started that horror movie and finished Emma, I'd been filming pretty much nonstop for about 11 months. And it got to the point on Emma where I was having panic attacks every day. And I didn't realise it at the time, but basically I think my body had started to associate film set with danger, you know? And so, like, even though Emma was an unbelievably amazing experience and everyone was like family by the end, and Autumn was a brilliant director, and just it was like a gift of a job, I couldn't cope. I was having panic attacks, and I thought I can never work again. I thought, I think this is it. I'm done. I've spent all these years trying to be an actor, and now I'm done. And
because you associated being on set with that anxiety, the two went hand in hand. Whereas actually, being on set, especially in the last 2 years, is the safest place to be. You know, it should always be the safest place to be, but also the healthiest place to be, because everybody's being tested, and that's by the by. That's another thing. Mm. So, how did you not only come to terms with this, but sort of deal with it?
Well, I didn't work for about a year and a half because of COVID, which I think helped.
Right.
As in, I planned to take 6 months off, and then COVID hit and I had Peaky, but then Peaky got pushed by almost a year.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of forced into a bit of a kind of hiatus, really. And I think time was good. But also, so
do you think in retrospect that was healthy for you?
I think I needed it, because I think I had reached a point of like emotional and physical and psychological exhaustion and burnout, actually. And I'm not saying this lightly. I had a breakdown. Like, I got to a point where I couldn't leave the house. I would leave the house and I would cry. I was so overwhelmed by just everything. And so I found myself in a kind of a hole, basically, that I didn't feel like I could get out of. And it put all of the kind of any depression or anxiety I'd had in the past just pale in comparison to how I was feeling. And then I'd helped myself. I got put in touch with a great psychiatrist and a great therapist by a friend. And I was diagnosed with PTSD. And I started a very specific type of trauma therapy called EMDR, which is where you...
Explain to me what EMDR is.
So EMDR is like, instead of talking constantly for an hour, which if you're talking about traumatic situations can be quite intense.
Yeah.
You go into very specific memories, and you work on those memories while you basically follow the therapist's hands, go from left to right. And what it supposedly does is it taps into your rapid eye movement part of your brain. And the idea is that you're revisiting trauma, but the movement of your eyes following something is keeping your body in the present moment. And so what it does is it kind of desensitizes your brain to that traumatic memory, because it sort of... it allows you to revisit the memory while sort of knowing that you're safe and you're here and you're now and you're not in the trauma anymore, which is kind of tends to be how PTSD works. It's like you go back onto a film set and you think that you're back on that horror movie, and then you have a panic attack.
Yeah.
And so EMDR was like the thing that meant that by the time I started Peaky, I mean, it was amazing, because I went back on a set, and obviously I was nervous on my first day, as anyone would be. But I kind of just had this moment where like the healthy part of my brain clicked back into place, and I was like, I love my job. I love my job, and I love being on set, and I love the community, and I love this person. And, something happened, something changed, and I think it was a gradual sort of healing. But yeah, I kind of just and I think COVID did help because I just had some time off.
Yeah, but you say something happened, something changed, but you were in the driver's seat of something happened, something changed. You acknowledged that something was wrong.
Yeah.
And you went, right, well, now is the time to acknowledge this and see what we can do about it.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, I was heading for that anyway. I think I'd always had anxiety since I was a kid, and I'd had a very unusual childhood. Excuse me. I think at some point I was probably always heading for a moment where I was going to have to stop for a second and change some things in my life. But I think that didn't mean I should have been traumatized on a film set. I just think being traumatized was a very shortcut way of making that happen.
But I think...
I still don't think it should have happened, though.
No, it definitely shouldn't have happened. But possibly we're all heading for a moment where reflection is needed.
I think so.
I don't know. I mean, I can only speak for myself and also the conversation we're having right now. Because, you know, there's loads of things that you're saying that I acknowledge and think, maybe there's a moment that needs to be looked at, or we need to step back, you know, and sometimes we're not lucky enough that there's a global pandemic where our work is taken away from us.
Yeah. I mean, it was also precarious because I'd quit modelling, basically. And so financially, it was a shock because
had you made that decision to go, right, there's no more modelling? The acting is the focus now.
Yeah, it was made properly like 2 years ago. Yeah. So yeah, it was COVID that really did that. I think COVID did that. I mean, I sort of like hate talking about COVID still, but I think...
Oh, me too. We don't talk about that on this, but it comes up because it has to.
But in one quick little sentence, like, I think it put a lot into perspective for a lot of people. And I think it meant that when we all went back to sort of like, quote unquote, normal life, there were certain things we went back to where we went, hold on a minute, I don't like this anymore. I don't want to do this. And, you know, it was the same for me with other things. Like, I didn't want to be social every night of the week anymore. I realized that I really needed time just to sit and be quiet. And, you know, that is one of the things about COVID that I really liked. Not the pandemic part of it, but just the space and the time. So yeah, I think it was kind of weirdly quite, it was good for me in terms of a mental health sense for sure, to have time off and some time just to kind of not be busy and heal from what had happened. Cause it was a really bad experience, that film, you know.
But also, do you think with that time off and reflection, you've gained a lot of tools to combat anything that should come up in the future?
Yeah. And I think anyone who's had a really bad, bad period of mental health will know it's like, in a weird way, I think you can recover, but I also think in a weird way you're never completely the same again. And so I think there's... I still get moments, you know, my PTSD will flare up and I'll have anxiety or I'll be knocked by something and I'll fall a bit into it. But what I've found now is that it doesn't really last that long. And definitely there are things about the time off that we had that sort of taught me how to deal with it. And it is literally as simple as things like go and do some gardening for 4 hours or switch my phone off or like...
Things like that are so important, you know. I head into the kitchen and I find the most complex recipe. Couple of onions. Look, during lockdown, I was making a recipe with 40 cloves of garlic.
God. Wow.
Look, it was the greatest curry I've ever made.
Yeah.
That was a good few hours of just being in there and just being in the zone.
Yeah.
Things like that are important.
Gardening has become my thing since moving house and inheriting this really amazing garden. I'm like, God, I need to learn how to keep plants alive and, you know, make it flourish.
Before I had to fly over to Dublin, where I am now, I have a little small garden at the front of my house, and I made sure it was all weeded and it was all clean, ready for me to plant when I get back, because I know it's going to all bloom and I'm going to get my pansies in and I'm going to get
my tree
and it's going to be beautiful. So, things like that are a good thing to look forward to.
Yeah.
Speaking of good things to look forward to, or good things that have passed, and obviously you know this podcast, I don't talk about jobs that much, but I know having you on this podcast, people would be upset with me if we don't talk a little bit about Peaky Blinders.
Peaky fucking blinders.
Talk about safety, nurture, kindness, happiness, integrity. How was it stepping into such an elaborate, that's not even the word, is it?
Established?
That's the word. I'm so tired.
I'm so sorry.
That's 4:30 in the morning for you, Amber.
Oh, no.
How was it stepping in?
Well, the exciting thing was the character, because of the last 2 years, because of the 2 years I'd had before I got Peaky.
Yeah.
Because I'd been so emotionally abused on set and drained.
Yeah.
I was just like, I would read sides for auditions, and if it said she bursts into tears, it would be like my body would shut down. I just wouldn't be able to cry. I'd be like, my body would just be like, nope, not doing it. It's not safe. And so I got the sides through for Peaky, and I obviously knew Peaky and I loved Peaky as a show. And so I knew that they were coming to the end, and I'd always sort of had this thought of like, oh God, wouldn't it be amazing to be in Peaky? But I got the sides through, and it was just to play this woman who just is a fascist. But,
oh, she's such a lovely character.
She's just a lovely,
what a lovely, kind woman. Soul she is.
But you know, she just doesn't give a fuck about anything, and she's not emotional, and she's sort of playful and mischievous and. Really just a delight to play as an actor who was just a bit out of gas when it came to like being really upset all the time. And so I read those scenes and I was like, yes, this is the mood I'm in. This is what I want to play at the moment. I don't want to go to work and feel traumatized. I just want to go to work and have a laugh. And obviously the subject matter is pretty intense because I am a Nazi in the show. But as an actor, you know...
In the show. Let's just make that clear right now. In the show.
In the show. But, it, you know, being able... compartmentalising that slightly, it was very, very fun to just be able to turn up and just say things and not care about consequences and not care about being liked and just be able to, like, drop a bomb and just, like, watch it explode and not really care about any of the after effect. And so that was the thing I found the most fun. And then, like we said before, it's about the people for me, and I made friends on that job that I love and cherish. And you know, the costume designer Alison and I still speak on the phone every couple of weeks, and the other actresses, Kate Phillips and Sophie Rundle and Charlene McKenna, like, oh, just brilliant, brilliant women.
Natasha O'Keefe.
Oh my God, Natasha O'Keefe.
Who is a very close friend of mine I absolutely adore, who absolutely refuses to come on this podcast. So we need to make a petition, everybody. O'Keefe, come on this podcast.
Yeah. She really welcomed me in, actually, because we were in Manchester and it was during COVID. Nothing was open.
I know, because I was there, because we were trying to meet up. Oh, yeah. Me and we were trying to meet up for a drink.
Yeah. And she would just text me and be like, do you want to go for a walk today? And I just thought that was so sweet because it was during a time when, you know, she really didn't need to go out of her way like that.
No.
And she was amazing. It was joyous, really. And it was, I was sort of sad in a way that it happened during COVID because I felt like we didn't get half of the experience, which was like the social extracurricular side.
No.
But I did also really enjoy turning my Manchester hotel room into a bit of a Zen retreat. And I took candles and things from London and kind of just moved in.
We do what we need to do. And also the fact that that social side of our career and our jobs was taken away.
Yeah.
We're now...
Making up for lost time.
Well, but also we're really thankful for the fact that in parts it's kind of back.
Yeah.
In a way. And we're thankful for it and we'll, you know...
But I think also, like, for me personally, Emma was another lesson in that we... Well, as I've said, I was emotionally spent. And Emma was a job where we all had dinner every night together. And I think that was... For me, too much. Like, I think the lesson I had from that was, like, I can do the dinners and I can do the drinks, but I can't when it's during the week and we have to be up at 4 because it's just, like, it's physically impossible. You just, you know, you run out of steam.
Mentally impossible.
Yeah.
My God.
Totally. I mean, there was a day on Emma when I had to be up at 5 and I left the hotel bar at 11:30 and I just thought, oh, my God, what have I done? And, you know, I learned that lesson very quickly. It was a shame that we couldn't socialise more on Peaky, but I also think it definitely did help me kind of conserve energy a bit. Watched the last episode on Sunday and I just really missed, I mean, it's going to sound so messed up because of who she is, but I did really miss the character. Am I allowed to say that?
You definitely, as someone who's played quite a lot of despicable characters in their career, yes, you are allowed to say that. Amber, this has been an absolute joy. I'm not gonna lie. I hope you've enjoyed it.
We didn't even talk about music, but
well, look, here's the thing, time. Right? We've got a part two in us. Already.
I think we do.
And hopefully our part two will be us in person around the table instead of on a computer screen. But there's a question that is sporadically asked. And I think it's something that isn't asked a lot. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you, are you ready for this question?
I think so.
Are you happy?
Yeah, I am really happy. Really happy.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah.
But podcast listeners can't see, but I can, you know what I can see? I can see it in your eyes and I can see it in your cheeks.
Yeah, my shiny, sweaty cheeks. No, I'm only joking. no, I'm really happy. I had like the worst couple of years of my life and then the best couple of years of my life, and I think there are things that happened to me during that time that just shouldn't have happened, like, but I also think that I'm the most grounded and happy and calm that I think I've ever been, and so I think some of it happened for a reason, and I have a really amazing relationship, and you know, not to say that you can't be really happy and amazing on your own, but that has definitely, of course, just been amazing.
Amber, this has been brilliant. Thank you so much for being my guest. This has been a joy.
Thank you. I'm sorry to keep you up late when you've been up since 4 a.m.
But... Shut up. I've got a late pickup tomorrow. It's totally fine.
Oh, fine. Fine. I'm not sorry at all.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Another episode is done. What did I tell you? She's brilliant. She's great. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. Thank you so much for downloading and supporting. Keep the messages coming through on social media. You know where we are. We're on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook. Well, look, I'm going to have to go. And you'll probably have to go too, because that was a longer than normal episode, but it was fantastic. Massive thank you to Amber for brewing up her pot of tea and joining me in the evening. And yeah, take care of yourself. And I shall see you next week for the last episode of the season. Let's go out with a bang. Until then, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. Take care. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.